I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
I know it was Amy. I know exactly what time it was. I am telling you what I remember her wearing, and I remember the bag.
She gave us, you know, kind of a theory of how she thinks Darren went, got into the house.
Can you believe in her mind she said, well, now because of me, this man came inside?
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
We continue to follow breaking news here on WTOP. Four people are dead, including a child, after being found in a D.C. house fire, and the circumstances are mysterious. WTOP's Michelle Bash joins us now live from Northwest D.C.
Yes, we just heard from Mayor Muriel Bowser and Chief Kathy Lanier here near the scene of this fire.
Even while firefighters were still on the scene of the fire at 3201 Woodland Drive, May 14th, 2015, we started learning more details from investigators. There was more to the story.
Apparently, a 2008 blue Porsche 911 with DC tags went missing around 10 a.m. this morning. It was found a short time ago, and police want to know if you saw it earlier in the day. Again, that's a 2008 blue Porsche 911 with DC tags. Police want to know if you may have seen that car. It may help their investigation.
The blue 2008 Porsche convertible was Amy Savopoulos's, though Sava drove it too. It was the same sports car that Claudia Alfaro noticed parked on the street when she and her dad went to the house earlier that morning, about 4 hours before the fire, looking for her stepmom, Vera. Sometime after that, someone drove it away from the home. The Porsche turned up later that day, about 45 minutes away from Woodland Drive, in the back of a church parking lot in Prince George's County, Maryland.
So there's kind of like two adjacent parking lots. One is the parking lot to the church.
A few months ago, Jack Moore and I went out to New Carrollton, Maryland, to the parking lot where the Porsche was found. It's near a big shopping center and a nice catering place called La Fontainebleau.
Looks like it's Iglesia Cristo.
The parking lot is tucked away behind St. Christopher's Episcopal Church. It's set pretty far back off Annapolis Road, a busy six-lane suburban highway. The thoroughfare is lined with low-slung strip malls, fast food places, and car dealerships.
Oh, wait, do you think this is it?
Yep, this is it.
It took us a minute to find it, but you're still able to make out a scorched section of blacktop near a corner of the parking lot.
So what would you say? It's just like fire damage still? The asphalt?
It looks like the asphalt has sort of been melted in a way, or something's been melted into it. It just looks like it's charred.
Mm-hmm.
The lot is bordered on two sides by wild thickets of grass and brush and overgrown weeds. And the brush is filled with trash. There are plastic crates and boards that someone placed down, making sort of a pathway through the overgrowth.
Yeah.
And there are several stray cats just climbing through the branches. In one corner of the parking lot sits a broken-down minivan. Rusted and battered, all of its tires have been swiped. As far as an aesthetic, It's probably about as far as you can get from Woodland Drive.
I was expecting sort of a big charred patch, but it's really not that way anymore. It's sort of just...
I mean, yeah, it has been 3.5 years. And it's weird, there's like right next to it, there's just a single woman's glove. Because this area is... Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of place where you would discard something.
When firefighters rushed to this parking lot on Thursday, May 14th, 2015, Amy's blue Porsche was completely engulfed in flames. It looked like a massive fireball. We saw it when prosecutors played a video taken from the dashboard of the fire truck. The sound you're hearing now is from that video. Firefighters arrived at about 5:30 p.m. that day, about 4 hours after D.C. firefighters rushed to the Savopoulos house on Woodland Drive. They suspected the car had been doused in gasoline, just based on how hot it was burning. Once the fire was out, investigators discovered an important piece of evidence, crumpled up inside on one of the floorboards. It was a construction vest. One of those yellowish-green construction vests with a reflective strip across the middle. Only part of the vest was burned in the fire. But the fact that it was in the car is not as odd as it sounds. As CEO of American Ironworks, Sava Savopoulos would have to visit construction sites sometimes daily. And he'd keep an extra construction vest in his vehicles just in case he needed to throw it on. But Sava wasn't the last person to wear it. When investigators analyzed the vest, they found traces of Darren Wint's DNA. It was one of the few pieces of evidence that irrefutably linked Darren to the case. But it wasn't the one that first established him as a suspect. The key piece of evidence that briefly made Darren Wint one of the most wanted men in America was back inside the burned-out mansion on Woodland Drive, on the crust of the piece of Domino's pizza that had been delivered to the house the night before. In this episode, we're going to lay out the forensic evidence investigators collected after the crime and how they linked it to their suspect, Darren Wint, the man who would eventually be convicted in the crime. We'll go through it piece by piece in a moment. But first, we want to describe for you what the Savopoulos house looked like in the hours and days after the fire, the environment that crime scene investigators encountered as they painstakingly searched for clues. During the trial, we got to see dozens of crime scene photos and a clip from an eerie video police shot inside the house to document the crime scene. The video begins with a shot of the front door, the address, 3201, laid out in gold above the white archway. The police videographer takes a step through the threshold into the foyer with the ornate light green wallpaper. The stairs leading up to the second floor are straight ahead. The videographer takes us up the steps, and at the top of the stairs, there's a library directly ahead and a massive chandelier hanging above. A turn to the right shows the bedroom where the three adults were found. Police called this bedroom one. Then the video takes us inside the room. The tops of the walls are smeared in heavy black soot, evidence of smoke damage. Fire didn't enter this room, but the smoke accumulated and tarred the walls and ceiling, looking for escape. A pan of the room shows the disarray, signs that something terrible happened here. And I have to warn you, this description might upset some listeners. In the corner of bedroom one, there's a very dark red-brown stain that looks to be about a foot wide. It's the remnants of a pool of blood, dried into the hardwood floor. Gathered up in one corner of the room are four chairs, three upholstered sitting chairs, and what looks like an office chair that swivels. The upholstery on the chairs is smeared with blood. Investigators found sticky residue on the wooden legs of the chairs that they would later determine came from duct tape. One of the chairs is overturned on top of another big blood stain on the floor. Peeking out from underneath that chair, a plastic bag with what looks like a lot of blood pooled inside of it. A wooden Louisville Slugger baseball bat lies across the end of the bed. It was engraved with Philip's name. It had been a birthday present from his grandfather. The end of the bat is a brownish red from blood that had soaked in. In bedroom two, the walls almost look like charcoal. The floor is covered in black soot. The bed is there in the middle, sunken into a melted web of burnt springs. Fire investigators would later determine that bed, where Philip's body was found, was where the fire started. The fire got so hot, it caused a complete flashover. A fire investigator later testified to that during the trial. That means everything in the room burned basically simultaneously. When firefighters discovered Philip's body there, they knew right away he was beyond saving. They placed a red tarp over the bed to protect his remains from any falling debris as they waited for the medical examiner to arrive. On the wall next to the door, as you walk into bedroom 2, a firefighter scrawled a message in the soot to warn other first responders. It's a standard mark. The room was a crime scene and should remain undisturbed. The scrawl read, "No go." Autopsies on all the victims were conducted in the first 2 days after the killings. Evidence of the horror that the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa suffered was written right there on their bodies. And that evidence was shown in court during the trial, projected on these big screens as the medical examiner delivered her report for the jury. The 2 days of the medical examiner's testimony were difficult for everyone. This has always been a horrific story. But coming out of the courtroom on the first day, when we saw photos of the injuries to Sava, Amy, and Vera, I was shaken.
It was just so personal, and it was so upsetting. And then to see, like, the actual wounds up close, you're like, I don't know.
That's audio of a call I made to Jack back in the newsroom. We recorded hours of our calls during the trial. As a reporter, I've covered a lot of murder trials, and I've seen things in court, photos of crime scenes and autopsies, that most people don't have to see. It's part of my job to look at the evidence so I can tell the story. But sitting in the courtroom that day, looking at their bodies, it was also the small details about their humanity that struck me, reminding me of how normal their lives were just hours before they were photographed in the morgue.
It was just crazy. Like, Amy had her toes painted red, and I thought, like, I wonder if she just got a pedicure. You know what I mean? Like, stupid stuff where you're like, that was a person that was alive 12 hours before this happened. And I don't know. I was just very, and her parent, her dad sitting there, I don't know how he did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, just think of your responsibility as a journalist to tell this story and
I had trouble expressing my feelings that day. I say I don't know a lot. While this was one of the hardest days of the trial, it was not unusual that I was talking to Jack. Most of the time, I was in the courtroom and he was back in the newsroom covering the trial for WTOP's website. Recording our brief conversations during court breaks was our way to stay on top of all the details from the testimony and break down what we knew and what still didn't make sense. You'll hear more of our calls throughout this podcast. I'm going to recap the medical examiner's testimony, but again, I have to warn you, this section is graphic and disturbing. After the three adult victims had been pulled from that smoky upstairs bedroom, Vera's body was initially rushed to the hospital in an ambulance. At first, emergency crews thought she might still be alive, but they were wrong. They couldn't get a breathing tube into her throat because rigor mortis had already set in. Rigor mortis, the stiffening of muscles after death, is an indicator that's used to establish time of death. Rigor mortis had set in for all of the victims by the time first responders got to the burning house, but the medical examiner said she couldn't give a time of death for any of the victims, in part because extreme heat, like from a fire, can speed up rigor mortis. But the medical examiner could detail the numerous injuries each victim suffered. It's gruesome. And to be honest, we struggled with how many of these details to share. There were internal debates about just how graphic we should be. Out of respect for the victims' families, how much of the story should be left untold, we wondered. Amy, Sava, Vera, and Philip all suffered multiple injuries. Detailing them all would be too much. Ultimately, we decided we had to describe the ones that the medical examiner believed caused their deaths, and the injuries that tell us something about the killer's mindset. As journalists, we're also left trying to answer, How could a person do this? Vera's body was covered in bruising. She had head injuries and other signs of trauma. She had a deep stab wound to the back of her neck, a stab wound so forceful, the medical examiner said, it fractured her spinal cord. The medical examiner could not say with certainty, but it's likely the wound that killed her. There was also evidence she was asphyxiated. Sava had significant head injuries. His skull was fractured in three places. His face covered in bruises. There was bleeding on both sides of his brain, and he had five stab wounds in his back. One of the stab wounds in his upper back went completely through his body and exited near his throat. It was that wound, the medical examiner said, that likely killed him. There was also evidence Sava had been asphyxiated. Prosecutors believe over the 22 hours the victims were held, Vera and Sava were suffocated possibly multiple times with that plastic bag investigators found on the floor of bedroom one. It wasn't to kill them, prosecutors said, but to torture them. Amy had severe head trauma. The medical examiner said she had been struck so hard it fractured her skull. There was a gaping wound at the back of her head. She was stabbed 8 times, 3 times in her neck. One of those stab wounds hit her carotid artery and jugular vein. But the medical examiner couldn't say with certainty which injury killed Amy. Each of the adults had burns to their body from being so close to the fire in the next room. There was evidence they were bound to their chairs, Amy and Vera with duct tape, and Sava with zip ties. The medical examiner found what appeared to be grooves around his wrists, where he'd cut himself, struggling against the restraints. And Philip. The medical examiner said he'd been stabbed at least twice in his lower body. Because his body was so badly burned, the medical examiner could not say for certain whether the stab wounds killed him or whether he was still alive when his body was doused in gasoline and set on fire. She said he either bled to death or burned to death or both.
I just don't want to, like, I don't want to write about this.
Yeah, I'm like, to be, I'm like actually so glad you were there because I know I would not have been able to not look, but then I know it would have like haunted me.
I know. That's what I'm thinking. I'm like trying to like let go of the images in my mind. I just have to get through this one part.
Hi guys, Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around DC. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out The DMV Download. Thanks. The Savopoulos house was held in evidence for 3 weeks as crime scene investigators, technicians, and forensic analysts examined every inch of the house for clues. Whenever a piece of evidence was collected, it was photographed in the spot it was found, bagged up by a technician who was wearing gloves, and sent off to the DC Police Department's Central Evidence Unit. Investigators filled box after box with evidence. Pieces of duct tape found in the driveway, photographed, bagged, and sent to the evidence unit. The black baseball bat, the one downstairs that would later test positive for Vera's DNA, photographed and sent to the evidence unit. Same for the bloodied baseball bat in bedroom one. Investigators later determined through DNA testing the blood was both from Sava and Amy. A construction helmet laying on the floor of the garage. A men's gold Rolex watch, photographed, bagged, and taken into evidence. It was sort of odd. The house was actually full of valuables, like that Rolex, and they appeared basically to be untouched by whoever carried out the killings. There were two MacBook computers downstairs and an iPad in the kitchen. There was fine art hanging all over the house, and more stored in the basement. Amy was still wearing her wedding ring, although the medical examiner would later say it looked like someone may have tried to unsuccessfully wrench it off her finger. Salva's wallet was still in the pocket of the pants he was wearing. And this detail sent reporters in the courtroom spinning. In the upstairs library, in an unlocked file cabinet, investigators found $13,000 in cash in Ziploc bags. It was sitting next to four unloaded handguns and several boxes of ammunition. We wondered, did Salva ever think about using the cash as leverage or breaking free to get the guns? He couldn't exactly direct the kidnapper to the money if the guns were right there. Even though it was just across the hall, investigators said it didn't appear anyone had rummaged through the file cabinet. The guns and the cash were untouched. It's another one of those details that makes your mind wander. Here's another one. At the top of the stairs, investigators found a sweater, balled up and soaked in gasoline. Right next to it was a spilled box of 300-count diamond brand green strike top matches. The fire in bedroom 2, where Philip's body was found, started on the bed. But the fire never took hold in bedroom 1. There was only smoke damage. Was the killer trying to use the soaked sweater to start another fire? And where did the gasoline come from? The only gas in the house was downstairs, in this little closet in the garage. Inside, investigators found several red plastic gas cans, the kind many homeowners have to refill their lawnmowers. But they were covered in dust and cobwebs, and they looked like they hadn't been moved. Investigators never found the gas that was used in the fire. And it wasn't the only thing they couldn't find. The cell phones that we know Salva and Amy used to make those calls to Jordan, Domino's, Nellie, and Sava's sister, their two white iPhones, were not in the house. They were missing. As crime scene investigators scoured the house, they continued turning up evidence. Several cables had been cut in the utility room on the third floor, where the computer storing the security camera footage was plugged in. And the computer hard drive was missing. Part of the metal covering one side encasing the hard drive was discovered inside bedroom 1, where the adults were found. It was photographed, bagged, and sent to the evidence unit. In the bathroom, attached to bedroom 2, where Philip was found, investigators photographed a large samurai sword propped up against the toilet, the blade's handle sitting just outside the bowl. It was covered in soot and heavily damaged by the fire. It was believed to be the murder weapon, one of them. But when investigators tested it, they didn't find any traces of DNA on the blade. The DNA evidence was likely burned off by the heat of the fire. Extreme heat can degrade forensic material. But a leather strap tied to the handle of the sword had blood on it. It was Phillips. The rest of bedroom 2 was so damaged by the fire, investigators had to gather up debris in buckets and carefully sift through it on the front patio. That's how they found pieces of Philip's clothing, still partially intact from the fire. A button-down shirt, a pair of khaki shorts with the front half burned off where it covered his thighs. They found a portion of his belt still in the loops, and part of a yellow tie with a sailor's knot pattern on it. All photographed and sent to the evidence unit. As investigators collected potential evidence from the house, evidence technicians worked around them, dusting for fingerprints. Every doorway and doorknob, the banister, light switches, countertops, anything they thought the killer might have touched. There were other analysts responsible for collecting thousands of hairs. Back at their lab, forensic experts would painstakingly mount each hair on a microscope slide and compare it with the victim's hair. Anything that didn't match could potentially lead investigators to the killer. On Saturday, May 16th, 2015, 2 days after the fire, a forensic biologist with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives named Emily Head arrived at the Savopoulos house. She was the lead DNA analyst on the case. You may be wondering why the ATF was taking the lead on examining DNA. BC's Department of Forensic Sciences lab had lost its accreditation, so for a while, the evidence from every city case was going to the feds. And how Emily Head got the title of lead DNA analyst was happenstance, really. The day after the fire, box after box of evidence started showing up at the ATF lab for testing. And because she was the only forensic biologist in the lab at the moment, Emily Head was given the lead role of DNA analyst on the case. She was asked to come to the house because there was a piece of evidence they needed her to swab, quickly, part of a pizza. In the crime scene photos of bedroom one, you can see two Domino's pizza boxes stacked one on top of the other near a windowsill in the corner. A closer look shows that blood is splattered on the top of one box. Inside was a whole uneaten cheese pizza. It looked like it hadn't been touched at all. The pieces were not pulled apart. But in the box holding the pepperoni pizza, several slices were missing. Left behind in that box was a piece of pizza crust, bitten into a crescent shape. Now, at the time, D.C. police had a policy it didn't collect perishable items as evidence. We learned that during the trial. There was also apparently some talk about whether they should even test the pizza crust for DNA. Emily Head told prosecutors she had heard police and other ATF analysts discussing whether they'd even be able to pull DNA off the crust. It had been there for hours. Someone claimed the sugars in the pizza might dissolve any potential DNA. We heard from a source at the ATF some investigators on the scene considered throwing it out. In the end, as you know, the leftover pizza was saved. The partially eaten crust was placed in a brown paper bag, like a grocery sack, and left in the upstairs hallway. When Emily Head arrived at the house with another ATF chemist that Saturday, there were still police officers posted at the front door, controlling who could come in. The two scientists were led upstairs to the library. Emily Head described on the stand how she went about setting up a lab in the middle of a burnt-out house. She used a long roll of butcher's paper and draped it across a desk in the library. That's where she tested the pizza crust. She swabbed both the bitten end and the crust end, the part where whomever ate the pizza would have held it. Of course, she was hoping for a match, she later testified. A person's mouth is full of cells, so there was a good possibility she could pull something off it if she did it right. At this point, 2 days after Sava, Amy, Philip, and Vera's bodies were found in the burning house, investigators didn't have many leads. They were chasing down every possible angle, looking into the family's background, recent visitors to the house, requesting phone records, delving into Sava's business dealings, searching for anything that might lead to something. They didn't know it at the time, but that pizza that investigators weren't sure what to do with at first would be the break in the case. So, we've told you about some of the evidence gathered from both inside and outside of the house connected to the crime. Now, we're going to tell you about the 5 specific pieces of evidence linking Darren Wint to the murders. This forensic evidence turned out to be a big part of the case against him. At least a dozen crime scene investigators, forensic biologists, and fingerprint analysts testified at his trial. Overall, investigators ended up testing 170 items for DNA. Emily Head's report on the case was 2,500 pages long. And not surprisingly, this part gets technical. The forensic experts who testified often spoke in this scientific jargon, which attorneys desperately tried to simplify. Jack and I went back through the trial testimony about the 5 pieces of forensic evidence the prosecutors introduced in their case. Here are the details.
Well, we'll start. So once again, I created a Google Doc of all of the trial testimony, focusing this time on the forensic evidence. And we broke it out into the 5 key pieces of forensic evidence. And we'll start with the construction vest, which they found, you know, this kind of lime green construction vest crumpled up on the driver's side floor of the burned out Porsche in that church parking lot in Prince George's County, Maryland. They swabbed the zipper pull, the neckline, the tag, the pockets. And on the neck and tag area, they said there were 2 major contributors. That's the term that they would always use.
Basically, when they say there are major contributors, that's what we would call a match. The DNA on the construction vest was a mix of Darren Wint and of Sava Savopoulos. There was a 1 in 40 million chance the DNA was from someone else. Investigators also swabbed the car door handles, or what was left of them, for traces of DNA and dusted for fingerprints, but they came up empty-handed. The DNA on the construction vest was the only evidence linking Darren Wint to Amy's burned-out Porsche.
Now, the 2 next pieces of evidence we're going to talk about are hair evidence. So these two tiny hairs, both found inside the house on Woodland Drive. The first one was found inside the construction helmet that investigators found on the floor of the garage. An analyst was dusting it for fingerprints back at the lab, and that's when she noticed this tiny wisp of a hair inside the helmet. So she was a fingerprint analyst. That's all she did all day, every day. She didn't have the tools to capture hair evidence. So this was like kind of one of those crazy stories that came out during the trial. She took a Post-it note and folded the hair into the Post-it note and sent it down the hall to where they do hair analysis.
Which, by the way, doesn't sound scientific to me. It sounds like a little, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it's a fine way of doing it, but I don't know how else you'd make sure you kept a little tiny hair and got it down the hallway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess quick thinking on her part.
Yeah.
Now, we never saw a photo of this hair, but the forensic chemist down the hall who ended up analyzing it, this was a woman named Amy Michaud, she described what the hair looked like in her reports. And her description was dark brown, curly, and about 1.5 centimeters in length.
So pretty tiny. Remember, they tested thousands of hairs. Some that came back to the victims, came back to dogs, to Ginger and Bear. Some came back to visitors who had been in the home. I mean, you can imagine the possibilities. An entire house. Think of just like what's in your vacuum every day. But in the end, only two little hairs mattered. So there was the first one in the construction hat. The second hair was found embedded in the bloody comforter from the bed of bedroom one. It was dark brown, curly, and about 2 centimeters long, and it was broken at both ends.
Now, that's important because the thing about hair evidence is hair does contain DNA. If the root is attached, you get something called nuclear DNA, which, I mean, identifies every single person. I mean, Right. Unless you're an identical twin, everybody has different nuclear DNA. But if the root isn't attached, which it wasn't in either case, then the only type of DNA you can pull is what's called mitochondrial DNA.
And mitochondrial DNA is not a perfect match to just one person.
Now, I didn't know any of this stuff. We learned this at the trial and we were like Googling all the different kinds and they explained it during the trial. But mitochondrial DNA is not unique to you as an individual. It's shared by you and all of your siblings so long as you have the same mother. It's inherited from your mother's side of the family.
So this is a big deal because remember when we told you at the beginning of the podcast, when we said Darren Wendt blamed his two brothers? That's where this comes back again. One of those brothers, a man named Stefan Wendt, has the same mother as Darren. So yes, this hair matches Darren Wendt, but it also matches Stefan Wendt. And from the defense's perspective, this is absolutely crucial. This is one piece, it's the only piece of forensic evidence that opens up the door someone else could have been involved in this crime.
We've been holding off on naming either one of the two brothers until now because they were never charged with any crime. And prosecutors say that they are completely innocent, that they were falsely accused by their brother. But in talking about the evidence, it's just going to be too complicated unless we use their names at this point.
There's no real reason their names should be dragged into a podcast or into, you know, articles or whatever. But the problem is, if that's his defense, and that's basically what the prosecution and defense had to parse how this could or couldn't happen, the brothers become main players in this.
Okay. Now, the fourth piece of evidence, going back to our Google Doc with all the evidence on it, the fourth item of critical evidence was this trace amount of Darren Wendt's DNA pulled off the handle of a knife. Now, investigators found the knife propping open a window in the basement of the Savopoulos house. And when we say trace amount, we're talking tiny trace amount. It's what's known as touch DNA. So it's not blood. It's not any other kind of body fluid. It's just these tiny, almost microscopic traces of DNA, like skin cells or saliva.
I thought it was interesting, too. The expert who testified about this said it depends. Sometimes you can leave touch DNA. Sometimes you can't, depending on if you just washed your hand. Maybe it's a little wet still. Or if you're sweating or something, you're going to leave more DNA than if maybe your hand's dry and you just touched something really quickly. So it's pretty incredible how sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But back to the knife in the basement, sorry. It was a major point of contention in the trial, but for a really odd reason, because it was not the murder weapon. There was no blood found on it at all. It was in the basement, a part of the house that really didn't seem to have much of a connection to the killings. And how they found it was sort of interesting.
So it goes back to when Emily Head went to the house to swab the pizza crust. She kind of also did this tour of the house and she was, you know, looking for other items that could potentially be evidence, other items that should be swabbed.
And so she's touring around, walking through the basement, and she goes into the bathroom, and that's where she sees the knife propping open a window. It was one of those windows you see a lot in basements where it's set up high in the wall. It's sort of smaller. And then it opens inward. You have to pull it toward you for it to open. The kitchen knife had a black handle. And in the photos, it looks kind of rusted.
And Emily Head wasn't the only person to see this kitchen knife propping open the basement window. Other crime scene investigators had been all through that house, and they noticed it too. And they said it looked out of place. But when Emily Head sees the knife, she requests that it be packaged up and sent to the ATF lab for fingerprinting, DNA analysis to see what they could find on it.
But after all of that, they weren't able to pull any fingerprints from the knife handle. They weren't able to pull any DNA from the blade of the knife. But there on the handle, they discovered traces of DNA, that touch DNA, enough for a partial DNA profile, one that ended up matching Darren Wendt.
The chance that that trace DNA on the handle of the knife wasn't Darren Wendt was
1 in 90 billion.
But we're still wondering, what was that knife doing in the basement window? I mean, we wondered that during the entire trial. I mean, we thought at first maybe it was the way that the intruder got into the house. But nobody ever said that. Neither the prosecution nor the defense ever suggested that the intruder slipped into the house through that window, maybe because it was too small. But no explanation was ever given throughout the whole 6 weeks of the trial for that knife propping open the basement window. Until the closing arguments.
The lead prosecutor, Laura Buck, suggested that Darren went down to the basement while he was waiting for Jordan Wallace to drop off the money to make sure that Sava's assistant really did what he said he was going to do. So along with the bathroom, there's a little kitchen down in the basement. And Laura Buck said perhaps Darren grabbed the knife there and used it to prop open the window in the bathroom. He wouldn't necessarily have been able to see Jordan directly walk into the garage, but he might have been able to hear him open the Mosler door and close it. We don't know if that's what happened, but that was the prosecution's way of accounting for that knife. So it wasn't the murder weapon, but Darren Wendt's DNA was on the handle of the knife. They felt like they had to come up with some kind of explanation for why it was there.
Okay, the last piece of critical evidence.
Bum-ba-dum.
The pizza. We saved it for last, but this was actually the crucial first piece of evidence that linked Darren Wendt to the killings.
Emily had swabbed the pizza crust on both the bite end and on the crust end. And in both places, analysts found traces of DNA enough to form a profile. And they fed that profile into a law enforcement database called CODIS, which stores the DNA of millions of people, both known and unknown criminal offenders.
And there was a match to Darren Wendt.
According to Emily Head's analysis of the pizza crust, the percentage of DNA match to Darren Wendt was even stronger on the crust than on the construction vest or the knife. There was a 1 in 10 quintillion chance it was not him. We were hoping to talk with Emily Head and other ATF analysts about their findings. We reached out to the agency and waited. In the end, the ATF declined to make Emily Head or anyone else available for an interview because the case is still ongoing. Darren Wendt's lawyers have filed paperwork to appeal his conviction. A spokeswoman for the Bureau did agree to provide written responses, but only to general questions, not specifically about this case. So we took the opportunity. We wanted to know how analysts like Emily Head, who are called to a crime scene, go about looking for potential evidence. In her response, the spokeswoman wrote, "The ATF lab specializes in finding and testing touch DNA, so analysts are sometimes called out of the lab and to the crime scene to look for items that might contain this DNA. Remember, we're talking about skin cells, dried saliva, and sweat. It's not visible without a microscope." In her email, the spokeswoman said analysts like Emily Head, quote, "put themselves in the shoes of the potential perpetrator, attempting to determine what items or areas that person may have handled or come into contact with at the scene." Now, along with the ATF, we also contacted DC police for an interview. It took us a few months, several phone calls, and a little cajoling. But eventually, that interview came through. When we got to police headquarters for the interview, we had to ask about the pizza.
I can't think of any other case since I've been assigned to homicide that we used food as in the pizza crust to get DNA from that ultimately led to a closure of a quadruple murder.
That's D.C. Police Captain Anthony Haith. He's the head of the police department's homicide unit. Haith told us how the DNA on the pizza crust broke the case wide open.
That particular DNA hit came back to Darren Wendt. So quickly, you are then in the mode of trying to determine how did his DNA get into that house. So again, with the excellent work of the major case squad, with the lead detective being Jeff Owens, he was able to do some background and figure out who Darren Wendt was, and that just propelled the investigation in the right direction.
The person Captain Haith mentioned, Jeff Owens, he was the lead detective on this case. He handled every aspect of the investigation. Nearly everyone we spoke with mentioned Detective Owens and his role in the case. Owens was the detective who intercepted housekeeper Nellie Gutierrez at Woodland Drive the day of the fire and took her in for questioning. Nellie told us he counseled her later on about how to deal with her grief and her guilt. We learned during the trial that the day of the fire was actually Detective Owens' birthday. He had plans that Thursday night to celebrate with his wife, but he was on deck to handle the next major case when it broke. And that afternoon, he got the call that firefighters had just discovered four victims at 3201 Woodland Drive. We really wanted to talk to Owens.
Detective Megan Cloherty from WTOP. How are you? Yes. Well, I know you got your hands full, and it's a bad time to call you, so we'll start with that.
Detective Owens is one of the top homicide investigators at DC Police. He's often working multiple cases at once, and he's not really one for talking with the press. Someone we spoke with, who knew and worked with Detective Owens for years, said Owens is so averse to publicity, he couldn't even get him to give a speech at a colleague's retirement party. Instead, we interviewed Captain Haith. Haith knows the case. He oversaw Owens' investigation. Haith was also at Woodland Drive in the days after the fire and remembers what it was like. At the time, he was a senior member of the homicide unit. Now, he leads it. And he's adept at speaking with the media. Haith has answered reporters' questions at the scenes of some of D.C.'s most gut-wrenching and high-profile murders.
This particular case did, in fact, get, as you know, an abundance of media coverage. But you go in investigating every homicide with the intent of closing it and figuring out what, in fact, happened. Although this is definitely a neighborhood that we didn't frequent often, we still go in with the same mindset of trying to determine what happened.
Haith says that right away, investigators were looking for clues in anything they could find, both inside and outside the house.
You're looking at your deceased individuals. You're looking at who may be their business interests, who they may have employed at one point or another, other relatives. You're going to look at all of those factors.
And with four victims, that's only compounds the amount of work you have to do.
Exactly.
Plus, he had an interesting job. I mean, he ran a company, but it's
exactly.
A kind of company where there's a lot of cash payouts. Or, I mean, like
right.
That kind of construction type business.
And you're going to look at all of those things. Mm-hmm. And we did all of that. We were in the midst of doing that until we got the hit, and the hit put us in the right direction.
But at first, investigators wondered whether Darren Wendt was just the first person they tracked down. Then D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier said this in a press conference.
We have not ruled out that there are others involved, but I can't comment beyond that.
But when they became available, the wording in police documents made it clear they believed more than one person did this. A lot of our reporting on WTOP during the investigation was based on the search warrants and other court documents police filed in the case.
We begin with new details in the case of the three family members and their housekeeper murdered in Northwest D.C. The one suspect in custody has been in court, and prosecutors are suggesting this crime was not committed by just one person.
Court documents reveal another person could have been driving the family's blue Porsche the day it was found burned in New Carrollton just hours after the murders.
Darren Wendt is so far the only person accused in the deaths of the Savopoulos family and their housekeeper back in May. There haven't been many new developments in the case, though police suspect others were involved.
Police have said that they don't believe Wendt acted alone in the killings, but nobody else has been charged.
Those documents that we used in our reporting, they all have Detective Owens' signature on them. Another reason we wanted to talk to him. When we interviewed Haith, Jack brought some of those filings with us, including the criminal complaint. In it, Owens wrote, based on his knowledge and experience and his observations of the crime scene,
he believes that the crimes described in this affidavit required the presence and assistance of more than one person.
Right.
So police, you know, thought that may have been the case. When did that change? When did you figure out that it was only just one person?
If you're looking at the case with a fresh eye, a naked eye, you're going to believe that there were more than one person involved. I'm sure that there were many members of the major case squad, the homicide unit as a whole, that believed that more than one individual was involved. But you have to take what you have. And again, you have the DNA pulled from the pizza crust. The DNA came back to Darren Wendt. You didn't have any other DNA that came back. During the investigation, Detective Owens was able to obtain DNA from other individuals who I won't name that you may already have, but that DNA was also tested and found not to be present on the scene as well. So you take what you have, and that's what he had. He had Darren Wendt, the sole individual involved in only his DNA.
Darren Wendt spent 3 years in jail awaiting trial. For a while, some people thought he might flip if someone else was responsible or committed the crimes with him. But investigators never found any evidence of anyone else taking part in the crime. The other people police collected DNA samples from were Sava's assistant, Jordan Wallace, and Darren's other younger brother, Darrell. Analysts at the ATF lab ran those samples against what was found on the evidence, but nothing came back. Only Darren was a match. Now, just like Stefan Wendt, prosecutors say Darrell Wendt didn't have anything to do with this. They say he's innocent. But it took investigators a while to reach that conclusion. Stefan Wendt was never considered a suspect. Darrell is a very different story. Part of the reason is because Darrell was with Darren on the night he was arrested. We also know police compared fingerprints belonging to Darrell Wendt as well as Jordan Wallace's fingerprints to those found in the house. And again, no matches. In fact, investigators couldn't find any fingerprint evidence at the scene. They pulled plenty of fingerprints from the house, from countertops, from the security system panel in the foyer, from doorways, but they were never matched to anyone, not even Darren Wendt. His fingerprints were never found in the house. But what about Stefan Wendt, the brother who has the same mitochondrial DNA as Darren because they have the same mother? Despite the fact that it could have been his hair in the bedding, investigators never considered him a suspect. Up until the month before Darren Wendt's murder trial began, he was just Darren's younger brother, who happened to have the same mitochondrial DNA as the suspected killer in a quadruple murder. We were curious. Given that police initially believed the crime was the work of more than one person, why didn't they look into Darren's brothers right away?
You must have probable cause to do anything. We had probable cause from the DNA hit that came back from the pizza crust to get warrants and everything that we had for Darren Wendt. Just because he has other family members that we know were brought up at some point, that still did not give us the probable cause to go directly to that brother if we don't have anything else. Had we developed anything that would lead us to believe that the brothers was involved, then we will be going in that direction. But we never went in that direction because we didn't have it.
In the end, Haith says police followed where the evidence led them, and it all pointed to Darren Wendt, nobody else. So in all the people we tried to reach out to for this podcast, two of them, of course, were Darren Wendt's younger brothers.
So we haven't been able to reach Darrell Wendt, and I got Stefan Wendt on the phone, and I identified myself as a reporter. I said, I'm with WTOP. He said, okay. And then I said, I covered your brother's murder trial. He said, okay. And then I just spewed out this big thing about, you know, I want to be able to tell your side of the story. You know, what was it like to be accused by your brother, even though the prosecutors say you're completely innocent? And he just said, I have nothing to do with that. And I don't want to say he hung up, but it was clear the call was over.
Still, we're hoping Darrell and Stefan will change their minds. So if you're listening, give us a call. We've already told you about how investigators and technicians combed through the Savopoulos' house, collecting evidence, for weeks in the early summer of 2015. In all that time, there were instances of what you could call missteps in how evidence was collected and how it was documented. And Darren Wendt's attorneys, Judy Pipe and Jeff Stein, honed in on them throughout the trial to create doubt and suspicion around how the evidence was collected. Remember the ATF lead analyst, Emily Head, who went to the house to swab the pizza crust? She looked at other parts of the house, too. That's how she spotted the knife propping open the basement window, the knife that had Darren Wendt's DNA on the handle. But that knife wasn't the only item in the basement that seemed out of place. Emily Head testified that she also saw a screwdriver propping open another window down there. She actually pointed it out and suggested it be collected as evidence, too. But apparently it wasn't. It never made it to her lab for testing. Emily Head said those were the only objects she remembers seeing propping open windows in the basement, the knife and the missing screwdriver. But one of Darren Wendt's lawyers, Judy Pipe, a veteran attorney of the D.C. Public Defender Service, showed the jury crime scene photos that told another story. In them, you see another basement window propped open with what looks like a child's toy block, and still another window propped open with a red Frisbee. Who was propping open all these windows with random objects? We don't know. Firefighters said it wasn't them. They're trained to break out windows in order to ventilate a room, not waste time propping them open. Maybe crime scene investigators simply got too hot down there and needed a little airflow while they spent hours combing through the basement for clues. That weekend, it got pretty hot in D.C., almost 90 degrees, and all the power to the house had been cut off, so there was no air conditioning. And those random objects, the Frisbee and the toy block, just like the screwdriver, were never collected as evidence. Does it matter? We think so. The likelihood it was Darren who propped open the bathroom window with a knife seems less probable when you learn all these other basement windows were also propped open with random objects. And those weren't the only issues. In the master bedroom, Emily Head also saw the sheath from a sword. Sava collected swords. But was it the sheath from the same sword that had Philip's blood on the handle? We don't know. The sheath was never collected. More than halfway through the trial, Darren Wendt's attorney, Judy Pipe, showed jurors a new crime scene photo, one they hadn't seen from the prosecution. In the foyer, just inside the front door, lying on the floor, was what looked like a letter opener. It was gray, maybe it was made of metal, and it was pointy. The blade looked several inches long. It didn't appear to have any blood on it from the photo, but it was taken from a few feet away. We'll never know if there were trace amounts of DNA on that letter opener, because it was never collected into evidence. According to Emily Head, the house was also littered with empty and half-empty water bottles and plastic gloves, items discarded in the moment by firefighters and first responders. At some point, the crime scene technicians were told that the water bottles everywhere were likely used by firefighters, but they were never collected as evidence. Maybe that doesn't seem like such a big deal. But we know from the Domino's order that a 20-ounce bottle of Sprite was delivered to the house along with the two pizzas, and unlike the pizzas, the bottle of Sprite was never found. Did the killer take it with him? Or did it just blend in with all those water bottles? And this is kind of gross, but Emily had also told prosecutors that she only swabbed one toilet, the one in the bathroom attached to bedroom one where the adults were found, the one firefighters marked no go. She said the other toilets in the house appeared to contain urine, and it was her understanding they had been used by firefighters. They were never swabbed. Darren Wendt's lawyers told jurors that given the missing evidence and what they surmised was hundreds of people who had unintentionally contaminated the house, firefighters, evidence techs, police officers, experts, they said because of that, the whole crime scene was compromised. Then they suggested the jurors should also question some of the evidence that was collected, like that knife in the basement window. Judy Pipe said in her closing arguments for the defense, the problem with the scene being contaminated is that people's DNA gets on items they never touched. And she wasn't suggesting the improbable. First of all, DNA is pretty easy to spread around. You can leave it behind if you breathe closely to something. It can be shared in hand-to-hand contact. You can even transfer someone else's DNA. Experts testified that it is possible if you shake someone's hand and then touch something else, you can leave traces of their DNA behind. In this case, three different investigators did accidentally leave their DNA on evidence. Emily Head was one of them. But if they're wearing protective gear, like gloves, how could that happen? Emily Head said she was back in the lab swabbing a set of towels from one of the upstairs bathrooms when she leaned forward and her lab coat ever so slightly brushed against the towel. That's it. It was the only contact she remembers between her clothes or her skin or her breath to a piece of evidence. That light contact transferred a trace amount of Emily Head's DNA onto the towel. Now that sounds like it would be a major error, but it's not all that uncommon. In fact, Emily had said lab workers keep a database of all of their DNA profiles. So if an item tests positive for unknown DNA, they can rule themselves out. It's a control for any accidental transfers. And it doesn't just apply to ATF lab employees. There's a database that contains the DNA profiles of every investigator processing evidence and working on the scene. So if their DNA winds up on evidence, they can discount matches to coworkers as accidental transfers. A second mistaken transfer came from a crime scene investigator. His DNA turned up on a pair of scissors that were hanging on a wall in the stairwell down to the basement near some other household items and tools. The crime scene tech said he didn't even touch those scissors. He was swabbing something nearby. Experts told jurors it could have been anything, a drop of his sweat that landed on the scissors, or maybe he sneezed. So back to the knife with Darren Wint's DNA on it. His lawyers maintained he never touched it. So how could it test positive for trace amounts of his DNA? Well, the knife wasn't collected into evidence until May 20th, after Darren Wint had been identified as a suspect through the DNA on the pizza crust. Why does that matter? Because on the same day, May 20th, police went out to Darren Wint's last known address, his father's house in Lanham, Maryland, and collected as evidence some of Darren's clothes and belongings he left there. Both the knife and Darren's stuff were collected and likely arrived at the lab on the same day. Could it be, Judy Pipe asked, just like Emily Head's sleeve barely touching those towels, Darren Wint's property brushed up ever so slightly against the knife? Here's something else to think about. When Emily Head's sleeve grazed those towels, it left behind one half of a nanogram of her DNA. One nanogram is tiny. It's 1/1,000,000th of a gram. For comparison, a single grain of salt is about 58,000 nanograms. The amount of Emily Head's DNA from that accidental transfer is a very, very small amount, a half a nanogram. Now, this is important. The amount of Darren Wint's DNA on that rusty kitchen knife was less than one half of a nanogram of DNA, practically untraceable. So Judy Pipe asked, how could Darren Wint have picked up that knife and stuck it in the basement window when his DNA was just barely there? She asked, just like a brush of a lab coat or a handshake, could it have been transferred from something or someone else?
One third of all murder cases in America remain open.
He had told me that if I opened my eyes, he would slit my throat.
Each one is called a cold case.
The DNA evidence taken from the victim was a match. The linen rapist was at it again.
Based on the hit A&E television program.
A phone call is placed, one that changes a family's life forever.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
If you could see the fire in his eyes, he screamed at me, "You want it? Get your tape recorder out."
Get new episodes of Cold Case Files every Tuesday on Podcast One, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
I hope we've done a good job of relaying one of the major aspects of Darren Wint's defense, what his attorneys called drop balls, as far as the evidence goes. Clearly, the jury didn't think the potential mishandling of evidence was enough for reasonable doubt. They convicted Darren Wint. But as reporters, looking at this case objectively as possible, we found some of their arguments compelling. And the longer we looked at the DNA evidence, the more murky things became. Take the DNA on the pizza crust. There was actually somebody else's DNA on that crust too, on the bite end. It was mixed with Darren's. But Emily Head said there wasn't enough of the second DNA profile to do an analysis. Frustrating, I know. We needed an expert's perspective on all this.
Go ahead and just say your name and how you would like to be identified.
Okay, my name is Thomas Mauriello. That's Mauriello. I'm an adjunct professor here at the University of Maryland Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. I'm a forensic consultant.
Thomas Mauriello is a lecturer in the University of Maryland's Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. It's considered one of the best criminology departments in the country. As a private consultant, Mauriello is frequently hired by defense teams to poke holes in forensic reports that prosecutors are relying on. In a recent case out of Baltimore, which also involved a fire, Mauriello was able to prove that investigators had fumbled a crime scene, failing to collect evidence that might have pointed to another suspect. His testimony helped clear the case against the defendant.
Now, did he do it or not? I don't know. As soon as I start having a feeling one way or the other is when I lose objectivity. So I never try to get it. I never try to get to a point where I'm strongly convinced one way or the other. I focus on the evidence, and that's it, and let the evidence speak for itself.
Moriello manages the crime lab on the campus in College Park, Maryland. He teaches students how to examine a crime scene and where to look for clues because, he says, crime scene investigators can miss things.
People tend to try to shortcut. You know, no matter what your job is, we tend, after we do it for a while, to look for shortcuts, to make our job a little bit easier sometimes. In criminal investigation, I find that investigators quickly look for the quick answer. And when they think they have it, they focus on that quick answer and forget about all the other things that might be important.
In the case of Darren Wendt, he says the full picture may have taken time to develop.
You have an understanding of the total investigation as it's been presented to the public. But when were those things happening? So when they were processing the crime scene, did they know that these people were in there for an extended period of time? Did they find that out later on? Lots of times people processing the crime scene don't have all the additional information. If they had that, they might have done things differently or collected things.
When Jack went out to meet with Thomas Moriello, he brought the crime scene photos, some of our notes and reports from the trial, and our summaries of the expert testimony around those five key pieces of DNA evidence linking Darren Wendt to the murders. Moriello says he remembers the case from when it happened, but stressed that because he had not read the police reports, nor the evidence technician reports, he was only giving us an informed opinion, not the kind of thing that would necessarily hold up in court as expert testimony. That being said, from what he did see, Moriello didn't find any glaring errors in how police handled the case. But what about that mystery DNA on the pizza crust, the one mixed with Darren Wendt's? Moriello says it could have come from whomever made the pizza. And then there's such a small amount of Darren's DNA at the scene. Yes, there were five things that forensically linked him to the murders, but Darren Wendt's attorneys maintained that evidence was weak. They said if he was inside the Savopoulos house for nearly 24 hours, eating pizza, duct taping his victims, holding them hostage and torturing them with a baseball bat and a samurai sword, how is it possible he only left microscopic traces of his DNA behind?
Well, I mean, a good area that he was in a fire, correct? The fire is going to destroy all that. So if he was mainly in the areas where the fire was, that's why the fire was there, to destroy that, you know. So that's my answer to that, you know. People use fire to help destroy physical evidence, and they're pretty successful at it, you know. In spite of that, You could take the other side of the story and say, in spite of that, they still found some DNA that puts them there.
Moriello, who's written a textbook about the criminal investigation process, says people have a tendency to put too much stock in DNA evidence. In his book, he writes that TV shows like CSI and others have built up public misconceptions about crime scene investigations, depicting crime scene technicians as super people sitting in dark blue lit labs who can solve any crime if they're handed a microscope. The reality is a lot more complicated. Moriello says you have to look at the whole picture, all of the evidence, not just the forensics. And that's what we're going to do. We'll detail some of the other evidence in this case. In his opening statement, prosecutor Chris Bruckman acknowledged the bulk of their argument wasn't based on forensics. It was based on the other circumstantial evidence. He said it doesn't mean it's a weak case. The issue isn't the kind of evidence we have, it's what the evidence proves. But the remaining evidence doesn't only help the prosecution. Remember Amy Savopoulos' blue Porsche that was driven from the house and then set on fire in Prince George's County? Someone saw the person driving that car erratically out of D.C. and toward Maryland, just minutes after firefighters arrived at the burning house on Woodland Drive. Except that witness said the driver he saw didn't look anything like Darren Wendt. On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare.
And there's a car in the driveway, but
we both walked up there and there was no answer at the door. So we're not sure if she's home or he's home or they just didn't want to answer or what the deal is.
We tracked Darren Wendt's whereabouts during the 22 hours the family and Vera were held hostage. And a look at some of the key players in the courtroom.
The highest praise you can give a homicide prosecutor in Washington, D.C. is saying that she is a beast. Laura Bach is a beast.
This podcast was written and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. You can see some of the evidence we mentioned, like the crime scene photos, at 22hourspodcast.com. And we want to hear what you think. Send us any questions you have about the evidence or anything else you've heard in this podcast. You can email podcast@wtop.com or find us on Twitter at 22hourspod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam. Procession by Puddle of Infinity, available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse, Marimba on the Loose, and Closing My Eyes for a Moment by Daniel Birch, and Weirder by Drake Stafford. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.